Attention, Dan Morin. Hello.
Hello.
Please report to the front desk.
Your lights are on.
Mm. Come down and pick up your free turkey.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Turkey.
It's alive. And bites.
This was not part of this deal. Is getting worse all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So hi.
Hello.
How you doing?
All right. It's spring weather here, which is to say it is snowing.
Oh, nice. It is. I yeah. love starting a podcast with weather talk, and Mike doesn't let me do that anymore. So yeah, it's raining.
Screw
cats and
that guy.
It's raining cats and dogs here. We have the remnants of a typhoon that went Ooh. Across the Pacific and has now been funneled by one of those atmospheric rivers. Apparently in the next 24 hours, the Bay Area is going to get its entire average rainfall for the month of April.
Wow. That's a
yeah,
lot.
Yeah, yeah. We've only gotten an inch and a half so far in the last 24 hours, but there's more coming.
Yeah, it started off very nice here today, and then I was out for lunch, and we came out of the restaurant, and it was snowing.
Snowing.
And cold. And we were like, yeah, spring. Winter, the winter yeah. season around here is kind of like it's kind of like The Godfather. Just when you think you're out, suck you back in.
Oh, wow. The Godfather 3, you mean, which is not my favorite, but yes.
You know, spoiler alert, I've only seen the first Godfather.
Okay. You're making references to things you know. Well, I know that Boston weather in that time of year is extremely variable. I've seen Red Sox games on TV where they've been playing and it's been nice. And then they say, well, in the last four innings, the temperature has dropped 30 degrees. And
yeah,
I'm
going to a game next Saturday, not tomorrow, but next Saturday. And my dad, when he offered the tickets, he's like, well, it's April. So really, it could be anything from like 20 degrees to 70 degrees. There's yeah. really no way to know.
You know, the funny thing is, so I went to opening day for the Giants. Now we're going to talk baseball and turn more people off. Yay!
Yeah.
This is what people tune in for, right? It's not, I mean, it's the secret
I don't
podcast.
Know what they do turn in for.
No, who knows? We don't know. We went to opening day. I went with our friend Philip Michaels because Lauren couldn't make it. It was very sad, but we had Jamie is on a trip, a school trip to Belize, and basically she was leaving that night. And Lauren was like, "I'm gonna just be sitting there worried about getting back in time to take Jamie to the airport, so I'm not gonna go." I'm like, "All right." So our friend Phil came, which was great. He's an A's fan, not a Giants fan, but that's fine. He's a baseball.
He's still
fan.
A nice person.
Yeah. Well, here's the funny thing, you know, when you go to a Giants game, this was a day game, I'll grant you, but like, you got to have like lots of layers because it can be very cold on the Bay, even in the middle of summer. And it was quite nice because it was, you know, partially because it was a day game, but also it was just a nice day. It wasn't a hot day, but it was a nice day. And it wasn't particularly windy where we were. And so it was very nice. And I was amused by the fact that, because you're right, in April, it can be a crapshoot. You can get a very cold day in April, even for the Bay Area. Very cold is not that cold, but you can be miserable sitting there. Or it can be really nice. It's the difference is that on an evening in July, in Boston, you'll pretty much be guaranteed. It might rain on you, but yes. It's going to be warm.
Unlikely.
And that doesn't happen in San Francisco
I've been to games in San Francisco with you and Phil. And I recall having variable experiences
yep.
there.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, but what's also funny is that was a really nice game. That was Tuesday. They're supposed to play tonight. That's not going to happen. I don't know if they've officially canceled the game or not, but everybody was looking at the forecast going, it's never going to happen. There's going to be 2 inches of water on the field. It's going to be raining all night. They're just, you know, at what point they may have by now even called the game and said, forget it. It's just never going to happen, but they may make them the wait. But I feel like it would be nice for them to just say, because I was thinking about this. They've been telling us this storm was going to happen for a week now. And so now I'm going to switch from weather to baseball to science, which is to say, isn't great that we have weather satellites because it was apparent that this was going to happen in all the and computer models for a week now. And so it's like you got this beautiful weather and you're like, oh, it's sunny and it's spring and we just had really warm weather and everything's going to be great. And then somebody's like, no, actually, you're going to get 3 days of rain on the weekend. I'm like, all right, well, we knew it. We knew it in advance. That makes it easier.
Yeah, yeah. Science, can't trust it. That's what I say.
Interesting. Oh, they have, I have this just breaking news. Breaking news. 18 minutes ago, they canceled the Giants game. So,
That's good. It's good that we spent time talking about it, though.
Well,
speculating.
Again,
speculating.
The rain.
It's, you know, it's been an interesting week for speculation in the Apple realm, because we have this interesting duality where we have, on the one hand, stories about Apple deciding to shift chip architectures,
yes,
in the next couple of years. And on the other hand, we have them talking about building their Mac Pro. Not to say this is necessarily an either-or situation, but it's a heavy week to be talking about Mac stuff. And a lot of speculation out there about, obviously, the architecture changes, what those could be, what that could signify. I've seen a lot of people suggesting that, you know, an architecture change doesn't necessarily mean a switch to something like ARM, but could be some sort of custom Apple silicon that somehow works with like an x86 instruction set or is compatible with an x86.
Could be.
It's certainly possible. Possible.
I don't know enough about the details of chip design and chip architecture. That is not my thing. It has never been my thing. Not even as like a fan of that stuff. Like, I listened to John and Marco talk on ATP about like different chip parts and stuff, and I think, oh, interesting, because I have no idea about that. I just it's not my thing.
I know just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah, exactly right. Whoa, dangerous for sure. So, but I did see some people speculating that there are lots of ways Apple could do this that are not... This goes back to what I was saying in my Macworld column, which is that this is the parable of the blind man and the elephant, where like we've got information that but we can't put it together into what the actual strategy is. We just have different data points. And on the ARM processor or the Apple processor transition point, because I think that there's a question about like, just because it's an Apple processor doesn't mean it's just one of their A-series processors in there. I saw somebody speculate that, you know, they could partner with AMD and have a core, you know, that is an x86 compatible core that they build into a processor that is also got Apple ARM stuff in it, and that it's just a non-Intel processor that is you know, just like my Mac Pro here has the T2 plus the Xeon in it. Like, Apple could just say, we're going to create a whole line of computers that have a weird hybrid architecture. They could also just say, nope, it's all ARM and we're going to emulate x86. They could also say, like, we're going to just do all ARM on the consumer level systems, and our pro systems will have a, you know, either have an, they'll still have an Intel processor, they'll have an AMD processor that will execute x86 instructions at full speed, or we've built a custom processor that has the ability to execute both sets of instructions, you know, in a partnership with somebody like AMD. All of these things are possible. I don't know the degree of possibility is linked to the degree of difficulty, which, again, I think experts would have to weigh in on this stuff that I'm not. But I think it's, you know, the bottom line is like what Apple, even with R&D costs, what Apple pays for one of its own processors versus what it pays for an Intel processor is not even close, right?
Sure,
so
right.
Could they afford in a pro system to put ARM and Intel? Well, yeah. I mean, they're already sort of starting to do that. So they could totally go down that route.
And that raises questions because of the timeline that we've seen from the data points we have, right? Because the rumor for the transition was 2020. And this, you know, Matthew Panzerino's TechCrunch story, where he interviewed a bunch of Apple executives about Mac Pro, basically says that's coming in 2019. It's a little weird to launch a new brand new product a year before you decide to transition all of your architecture. So will there be a tip of the hat? Like, I think your point about potentially a system that has some sort of combination of x86 chips and ARM chips might be more palatable on the Mac Pro, especially. The one thing that was interesting about that, so they talked to, you know, the big thing to sort of take away from that was this whole workflows idea that they're working with creative professionals to look at what they're doing and try to design something from that. I did notice that the one thing sort of left out from that, they mentioned video production, they mentioned 3D animation, they mentioned music production, all of which are obviously very intensive. But the biggest class of people I know who want pro hardware are developers. And, you know, on the one hand, maybe Apple figures, we're a company full of developers, we don't need to bring in outside developers to figure that out. But
I'm sure
I would argue that developer needs are different, certainly workflow-wise, than all of those creative professionals. I'm curious to know, I mean, does having, you know, that sort of hybrid approach, is that helpful for developers, especially those developing iOS apps, if you have a native processor?
Right. I mean, that's one of the things that I've thought about all of this stuff with the Marzipan stuff, the idea that there's potentially a unification of app building across platforms, and thought to myself, it would be a very interesting thing if you are a, if you're an app developer and you have the ability to, execute that stuff. You can already execute it in the simulator, right? But if you could execute you know, in an emulator environment where it's running it's not doing an Intel build, it's running the ARM code and it's just running it. I mean, I think they build Intel code and then run it, but it's, you know, in the simulator. But still, you know, you still want to test on device. So I'm not sure it makes that big a difference. I think the key is, like, can you do development work on that device? I'm sure that Apple will always make it so that its developers for its stuff are taken care of to a certain degree. But I have also heard from a lot of people, and John Syracuse mentioned this on ATP this week, like, there are the web developers who use, like, Docker, and they're using, you know, they're working on stuff where they've got an Intel server environment, basically, that they're able to build on. And if you move to ARM, you lose that. You move to ARM, you lose your Windows, your native speed Windows emulation. You do lose a bunch of stuff like that, which is a bummer. Although, you know, I'm sure Apple has a very clear idea of, you know, how many people are relying on that. And also, I'll point out across the fence, over on Microsoft's side, they're doing Win 10 for ARM with emulation.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, it could all fail, but I think not. I think that is a response to very much what Apple's looking at, which is, you look at the Qualcomm, in that case, mobile processors that are ARM-based, and you're like, damn, 20 hours of battery life in a laptop. Sure, you give up some stuff, but how could we not? And so now Microsoft's just like, sure, we're going to also have ARM stuff that we support.
Yeah, I mean, if you can get 20 hours, if you can do 20 hours of work on a laptop, even if you're only doing some stuff at slower speeds, I mean, there's a lot of people who would take that trade-off, right? Like, I would certainly trade off 20 hours of life on my phone for, you know, maybe performance that isn't quite as good.
Right.
Because I'd rather have longer usage of my phone because most of the stuff that I'm doing there doesn't care as much about processor. Well, same thing with a laptop. Like, most of the stuff I'm doing on a laptop, that's a trade off that I would, you know, quite reasonably.
Yeah. And not everybody will, but that's the thing. You know, not every product has to appeal to everyone. You want to kind of cover the bases. Yeah. Apple's less than 10% of Intel's business. I think it's more like 5% of Intel's business. And that, one is, that's why it's silly that Intel stock took a hit on that report, because, Intel's business is not going to live or die just based on Apple. Although I do think it's worth, looking at that and having people say, this is a trend, right? Because throwing the Windows thing,
it's a leading indicator.
You know, could Intel get its business eaten up by Apple and Qualcomm, and end up with, you know, in a really bad state? That's worth mentioning. But also, the flip side of that is, if you're Apple, although you're a valued customer of Intel's, you know, Intel's whole product strategy is not based on your needs. And so occasionally we'll hear, like when the first MacBook Air came out, that, oh, Intel made a custom processor for us for this one because we wanted to do some stuff that their base models wouldn't have. And then that processor ended up in all the PC Ultrabooks that followed the MacBook Air. And then Intel was like, oh, this is a place we need to go. So I'm sure there's some malleability there in terms of Intel's product line. At the same time, you know, the bulk of those chips go to PCs. And so Intel's going to listen to Apple only to a certain degree. Whereas on the iPhone and the iPad, every decision Apple makes goes into their product for hardware on the product, for software that runs on the product, for sensors, you know, well, that's hardware, sensors, and then and the CPU. And it's all Apple controlled. And I'm sure Apple looks at that and the Intel relationship and is like, well, you know, why don't we just build this ourselves? Even if it was still integrating x86 stuff, if they did something like, you know, work with AMD on some of their cores or something like that. I don't know what all the limitations are in terms of Apple. You know, Apple probably doesn't want to build its own x86-ish sort of thing, but there might be options there. Or maybe they're just like, we're going to make one that's really good at emulating the stuff.
Sure. I mean, lots of options. I think a lot of this comes down to Apple's philosophy, I think, is that they got it's sort of a once bitten, twice shy thing, you know, over the 90s, right? Like, you know, all the stuff with them lagging behind in processor performance, they hated that. They hated, like, having to make, I'm sure, having to make those commercials and talk about the megahertz myth and all that, right? Like, that's not messaging they want to be doing. That's them on the defensive.
Oh boy, that Macworld New York, where they had to try to explain the megahertz myth laboriously. Like, it was so
RISC versus
bad.
CISC instruction sets, all that stuff, right? Like, they don't want to have to be doing that. They just want to be able to say, you know, and that's why they don't talk about that as much anymore.
So,
but I also think they want to be in control of their own destiny, right? In the same way that they were flirting with disaster in the 90s because of, you know, the whole ship essentially going down. It's the same reason I think they maintain, in some ways, such huge cash balances, is because they don't ever want to have to be in that position again. And that's made them very, very conservative about that sort of thing.
Speaking of sub 10% customer base, this is the reason that I still am a little bit unclear on what's going on here. The Mac is 8% of Apple's revenue.
Mm-hmm.
8%.
And the Mac Pro is, you know, what percent, or a professional level Macs, what percent of that
are less than 5%, less than 3%. I mean, even if you throw in there kind of higher end iMacs and MacBook Pros and all of that, and of course, 2/3 of the computers they sell are laptops. So
yeah, I mean, we've heard that the MacBook Air
does better than the MacBook Pro. So this is the part that hangs me up, which is why I think it's got to be part of a larger process that Apple's going through. And it may be that this new Mac Pro is intended as a kind of a last gasp of the high end that allows them to kind of do that high end Intel Xeon processor thing and keep that rolling while they then undergo a more dramatic transition. It could also be another step, like the iMac Pro is with the T2, of down the line of kind of creating these hybrid Macs that we've heard of before that are a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But it is such a small market that I just have a hard time grasping Apple putting the effort into it that is required, unless ultimately they have this larger plan, which is, you know, these are all different paths leading to an exit. And that exit is probably an exit from what we think of traditionally as Mac OS. That the Mac, when the Mac Pro comes out, and the Mac in 2020 and 2021, is not what we think of today. The apps are built using a different set of frameworks for the most part. iOS compatibility is more important. You know, it's maybe more like an iOS device. Or the alternative is that Apple's really, you know, when they say they're going to be ARM chips and Macs, you know, are they going to be Macs really? Or are they going to be something that is like a Mac, but is not a Mac? And that's also a possibility here. Because again, 8% of Apple's revenue comes from the Mac.
I mean, on the Mac Pro front, part of me suspects that what we might end up seeing, I mean, they've talked about modularity being a huge part of that. And that can mean any of a variety of different things, all the way from modular components all the way up to, like, you know, something with a detachable screen. I don't know. I mean, like, modular can mean any number of things. Part of me suspects, and I wrote a column for Macworld about the, like, envisioning sort of what this Mac Pro might look like based on, like, reading between the lines. But part of me thinks that if this is sort of a last gasp, that if they set a device out there that is modular to the degree that some of the old Mac towers were, in the sense that components can be taken out and upgraded much more easily, whether it be the processor, the RAM, the storage, video card, etc., it at least gives them leeway, because rather than them having to be tied to updating it every single year, right, in the same way that the last Mac Pro they let sit forever, that if you at least have an upgrade path where you can go to a third party and be like, I'm going to put in a new processor, I'm going to put in new RAM, I'm going to put in, you know, new storage, that doesn't solve all of your problems, but it does potentially give them a lot more leeway to not have to update it as regularly, because they can be like, go buy off-the-shelf components and do it yourself. Like, this is the market. This is the market that's what they want. They want the ability to swap out hardware. And it's not a big market, but, like, if you throw them a bone, and then it gives you some time to sort of walk away and be like, now we're transitioning the rest of our business to something else, but you guys have this, and it will last you at least a few years. Good luck.
Well, and it may be that their plan really is that, which is we hear from our pro users and we're going to have a pro path that we walk, and it's not the path we walk with the rest of the line. And that means the rest of the Mac line too, right? Like it could be that simple that the rest of the Mac is going to shear off and become, you know, increasingly ARM based and iOS compatible. And the pro line will pick that stuff up, but, you know, will cost more and have this other stuff that gives you that level of compatibility. You know, does that mean that in the end, like, if you want to run Windows on Apple hardware, well, there are these models that let you do that, but that's it. Like, that's all we're going to do.
Sure.
That may be the case.
Well, it's kind of like the division at some point. Like, even if you were buying a Pro Mac, you probably weren't buying, say, an X-Serve, right? Like, the X-Serve is a Mac. It runs very specific hardware, but it's not a device that most people are going to buy. And I feel like that might be kind of the pathway that you're talking about here, where it's like, this is a Mac. It's not the thing that most people want when they think of a computer. But if this is what you need, then you can do that. But again, like the same way that the X-Serve, I'm sure, was always a tiny portion of their Mac business. It may be that going forward, those pro level Macs are also a tiny section of their business. But at the same time, you know, all the time that they're spending investing this, as you said up front, like that's what makes this somewhat weird. It's like they're spending a lot of time. And I think I made this point a little earlier this week, but I think what's fascinating to me is the Mac Pro, the trash can Mac Pro. I think Apple fundamentally had some weird, almost crisis with that. They designed what they believed to be a beautiful product. And I think a lot of people would argue it is a beautiful product. It's exceptionally well engineered in most ways, but it wasn't what the market wanted. It
exactly.
wasn't what those people wanted. And Apple kind of sat there for a while. Like I assume it never sold to the extent that they wanted it to sell. And I think they had real trouble reconciling that because they realized how far they'd gone off the mark in terms of building something that felt very Apple-y, but was not even remotely close to what those customers were looking for.
Right.
And I think that's part of why it took so long.
They used all their product magic on it, and the problem was it didn't work. Like, that magic was not for the people who would buy it.
Right. Those people would literally have been happy to get a new cheese grater Mac Pro with better internals. Like, they would not, they would have all bought, like, lined up and bought that.
Yep.
So that's what makes it really interesting to see what, like, they're taking their third shot here, and I'm fascinated to see what they are going to come up with, because I think it could either be a really solid product or I think it could be another utter disaster. It's basically impossible to tell.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you mentioned the workflows earlier, it does seem like what they've decided to do as a remedy for the idea that they had no idea when they built that trash can Mac Pro. They thought they were going to push. I think this is the truth of it. They thought they were going to move the market, and the market didn't move. The market didn't move, not just the users, but like the way that pro software was built, where they were like all in on GPU computing and powering those GPUs. And it didn't really work out for most applications. It's like, nope, we're not going to do that. So they ended up in a box. So they built this workflow thing, according to our friend Panzer, Matthew Panzerino at TechCrunch, who got the story this week, that they're building these workflows where it sounds like they're putting some video editors and stuff like on contract and musicians and music producers to do work on like sample projects that basically allow them to Apple to watch them. And I find this supremely bizarre. I'm sure there are reasons in the details, but like we were talking about this with our friend Joe Rosensteel, who's a VFX artist, right? And it's like, I have a hard time believing that putting a music producer on contract to have them sit across the hall from the people who are building pro apps or pro hardware. I have a hard time understanding why that would be more effective, cost effective, time effective, and in terms of like real world content than hiring somebody to watch them and talk to them in their actual workspaces doing actual work. Like, they could bring a VFX artist, for example, like Joe, into Cupertino and have him do little fake projects, or they could just send somebody to the VFX shop that Joe works at, or where Todd Vaziri works at ILM, or, you know, one of these places, because we know some of these people, and just have them watch. And maybe they're doing that too, and maybe there's certain areas where Apple's like, well, this is really complicated. Why don't I just have you come in here and build this project for us?
But it's that weird Apple-y way of like, let us bring you into the Apple fold and we will study you like a creature. And like, it's bizarre because it's out of the natural habitat, right?
Like that they're listening, right? Yes. It's great that they're saying, look, we're going to build our stuff with pros in mind. And so this time we're going to get it right. And there was that great anecdote about how they just, which calls a lot of questions to me, because why didn't you notice this before? But like where they were observing somebody using, I think, Final Cut, and there was a window that came up and it took like several seconds to draw it. And they're like, whoa, that is really bad. And they found a bug and they, in like a driver, and they fixed it. And now it worked, you know, much better. But I'm sitting there thinking, you know, you can do that without bringing somebody in on a contract to do fake projects for you across the hall. You could actually watch your customers work in their working environment.
And that's the thing, is no one, this is a great idea as long as all those people in the real world end up working in an Apple environment. But as soon as you go outside of the Apple environment, like, and I mean the literal like Apple campus environment, their workflows are going to be different, because if you bring someone like Joe in there and sit him down and have him make fake projects, he's not dealing with probably all the stuff that he's dealing with in a normal day at another company, right? Fake environment it is literally like, you know, it's like getting some sort of endangered creature and throwing them in like a car, like a concrete room or something like that. It's going to be different.
This is why I end up installing OS betas way before I would normally do it on my main system. Be like, oh no, you should just have another system you run. I can't run another system. I can't run, like, I'm going to reboot into new version of OS 10 on my iMac, Mac OS, yes, 10.19.90, whatever it is. But right, so I'm not going to be in even higher Sierra beta for a while and then reboot into something else. Because like, what ends up happening is I boot into the beta and it's got nothing in it, and I kind of click around a little and try some stuff, and then I boot back into the main thing and you do my job. And what I realize is, and I realized this many years ago now, is unless I'm using it, I'm not using it. Unless it's real, with real content in it and real data, it's my computer that I'm using all the time. And I have a fallback, right, that I can boot into if there's a disaster. But, like, I have to use it. And that was when I read that workflow stuff, I was thinking about that, too, which is how real is this stuff, or is it more like demo-y? And, again, these people at Apple have thought about all of this, and maybe they have very good reasons for doing it. And I think it's encouraging in the sense that it shows that they're actually listening to their users of pro stuff and trying to understand it. That's good.
It's a step better than designing it in a vacuum, but it, like, at the same time, it's also like they could take it a step further and just go to their environment. Yeah, and maybe it's like a weird middle ground.
Maybe they do that too, and maybe they've always done that, and that the people that brought in are because they feel like they need way more detail, and at that point you're intervening in the job that they're trying to get done, and they're like, look, this is my living, I need to do this. And you're like, okay, how about we pay you for a project and we watch you do that project? And then they're like, okay. I mean, it could have literally been that kind of a chain of events that happened. But I don't know, it's fascinating, because there is this question, I feel like we could ask this question about Apple on a lot of fronts, which is what about corners of Apple's Apple is so big now because of the iPhone, that there are corners of Apple's business that used to be key revenue streams, key customer areas, that are now fractions of Apple's business. And the pro Mac user is one of them. We have a lot of people who listen to this, who read our site, who are pro Mac users on one level or another, right? But in terms of Apple's business, it is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of its business now. And so there's this question, and this is true of any large business, which is, how do you prioritize your resources? And do you say, even though this is 2% of our business or 1% of our business, it is on its own, Apple makes this argument a lot, on its own, it's actually a very profitable successful mm-hmm. business. And just like they say, the Mac on its own would be a very profitable, successful, large business. The iPad on its own would be a very, iPad Incorporated would be a large company with great sales. It's just swamped by the iPhone. That's all true. At the same time, you are one organization. You are integrated in ways. You don't have just the Mac Pro division off on its own doing its own work. It's got to be part of your hardware group's time. It's got to be part of your software group's time. All of that stuff is rolled into it. And so you end up in this interesting situation, which we may have seen play out in front of us with these, with the thing last year and then this thing with Panzerino this year, which is it, at some point a switch must have flipped somewhere inside of Apple where they said, look, it's, I know it's only 2% of our business, but it's an important 2%. It's important to us culturally. It's a profitable business, and it has some follow-on effects in terms of those people being more likely to refer, you know, other people and keeping them in the ecosystem and all of these reasons. And that, like, if we're going to stay in this business, we should do it right. And that's, that seems to be what has happened. But, cause you could very much make the argument that Apple as a company would be better off getting out of the Mac business entirely, like seriously, other than the fact that, you know, you have to do all of their apps on the Mac. But like the Mac is a fraction of the business. You could say, oh, like, why are they even being distracted by it? As a Mac user, I don't want to say that, but you could make that argument and it would be a fairly strong argument. Certainly, you can make the argument that it should be entirely in maintenance mode and they should be putting no effort into this stuff. And they should not be spending until 2019 to put out a Mac Pro because they could just pull the cheese grater out and put new internals in it and ship it and walk away and be done. And they're apparently not doing that. They're doing what they did with the iMac Pro, which is like, oh, but what if we did this new thing that you've never seen before, like the T2 processor and the iMac Pro. So, you know, I don't know. I can see that argument, and the Pro argument is like a microcosm of the larger argument about Apple's business. And it's tough because I understand when you're a huge business, there is a lot of pressure to be especially when you're as integrated as Apple is, you know, you can't compartmentalize these smaller parts of your business. You need to deal with them. I always said this about the iPad features in iOS. It's like, unless you give it some air, that product's going to die. And I know that in the moment, every single bug ticket that is iPhone is going to get prioritized over iPad because there is like an order of magnitude more iPhones than iPads out there.
Right.
But that said, you can't always prioritize the iPhone. You have to give the iPad some percentage of that or that product's going to die. Do you want that product to die? No? Well, then you need to do something.
It's diversifying your portfolio, right? I mean, on the off chance that tomorrow something happens and nobody wants iPhones anymore, at least you got a business to fall back on. And that's not going to happen, obviously. But again, I think some of Apple's wariness in this area comes from the lessons of its past, you know, where it only had one business. And when that business tanked, the whole company was in danger of, you know, falling into the sea. And they hit something with the iPhone, as we've talked about many times in the past, that is not likely to be repeated, despite their best efforts. And someday the iPhone may not be the business that it is today, in the same way that the iPod was a crazy successful business in the early 2000s. But iPod sales now are basically non-existent. So you always got to hedge your bets that someday down the road you may have to find a way to diversify that. Whether or not the Mac is the business to fall back on, that seems less likely.
That's the thing is that yeah, if iPhone sales falter, the Mac will not save them.
Sure. And it may be that they're just holding on to it out of like some weird misplaced nostalgia.
Well, and again, they don't have a replacement for it, so they would be turning people over to their competition. They don't have a development environment for it. For the competition, they only have it for the Mac. So there's reasons there to keep it alive.
Sure.
It is true that, you know, it's not just like, how do I put this money and time into the Mac over the iPhone? It's how do I put this money and time into the Mac over the next thing that could replace the iPhone, whatever it might be. And some of, again, probably can't replace the iPhone, but like that was Apple Watch at one point. And it's AR stuff and, you know, a headset or whatever they're doing or glasses or whatever they're trying out, or it's that car that we haven't heard anything about in a while. You know, that stuff is those are the bets for the future. And those are the other places that they need to spend time and money.
And not all of those will pay off either, but it kind of, you know, behooves you to try a lot of options and see what the next thing is. And I think in this particular case, I think the answer that we come down to is right now they still do need the Mac, right? Like, it's not to say they couldn't get rid of it if they tried really hard, but the effort that they're going to have to put into replacing the stuff that the Mac does that their other products can't do may not be worth it.
Well, I think the way I would put it is, they could get rid of the Mac, but those are a bunch of loyal customers and some valuable and profitable markets. And I think they would rather have, I have a hard time seeing them having the strategy that they're going to literally keep the Mac around as is forever. I think it's more like, what's the transition plan? How long do we have before we can offer, you know, for the bulk of their users, not necessarily 100%, right? And we're going to hear the people who are not in the 100%. It sucks to be in the 5% of people who are left behind, but it does happen. And this could be one of those examples where Apple's like, how do we get 90% of the Mac user base onto a computer of some sort that is basically running iOS, a future version of iOS?
Well, yeah,
and is that in 2 years or 5 years?
That was always the goal, I think, with the iPad, but it didn't quite pan out the way they expected it to.
Well, the iPad, and as I'm one of the you know, big fans of the iPad, but I would say it's Apple's fault, not the market's fault, because the iPad's not good enough, because they didn't advance iPad software fast enough.
I agree,
right?
100%. I mean, I think that's what they thought. They thought they were, again, it's kind of like with the Mac Pros, they thought they were giving the market everything it wanted, and it turned out, again, you can't always move the market based on purely based on what you deliver to it, and they did not iterate and improve on it fast enough that it was able to keep that initial groundswell when everybody was like, oh, the iPad, that sounds kind of cool. They couldn't keep up the pace of development there for whatever reason, or just decided not to, and that like lost them some ground there. But I think, you know, I think that's, there is an argument that a lot of people, you know, who need a computer can get by with an iPad.
Sure.
And that might become more and more people in the future, but I think they're going to have a more of an uphill climb with it than they might have if they'd sort of invested more time earlier. I don't know. I think that you're right that the Mac can't go on forever as it is, but there is still any number of questions about what that future looks like. And we've talked before about the fact that, like, maintaining two huge platforms that share some stuff in common, but also have a lot of very big differences, is a big challenge. So we'll have to see what comes of this sort of this rumored marzipan, you know, idea, where we're getting like a window into something Apple is thinking, but maybe not the clearest picture. But I think that there are more shoes left to drop. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's I think I could argue that part of it is, this is why I talk about the iOS laptop, is part of it is, well, I'm not going to get an iPad because I need a laptop. If there was an iOS laptop, would there be people who would buy it because they want a laptop? And suddenly it becomes more enticing as a platform than, because they don't want a tablet, they want a laptop, right? And Apple doesn't offer that right now. So I don't know. It's a fascinating time. This is, what we're talking about here is the disposition of a platform that Apple has had for 34 years. And there are some real questions about if it exists by the time it turns 40, or if it's completely unrecognizable, and or if it's just gone. And we don't know. Like, I don't have a great deal of, I wouldn't make a bet that in 2024 there are Macs running Mac OS being sold new by Apple. I wouldn't make that bet. I don't. In fact, I would probably bet that there aren't. At that point, I feel like by that point, whatever is out there is not running something we think of as Mac OS now. But how do they get there? And what's the tumult? And what's the frustration and all of that? That
the
I don't
drama,
know.
The drama, so much drama left to come.
Yep,
because people are going to be really, no matter what happens, people are going to be angry about it. I think that's the cardinal rule of the technology industry, is no matter what changes, someone's pissed off.
Yep. All right. Well, on that note,
what an up note to end on.
I don't know. It's a weird time. Weird time. Thank you to everyone out there for being a Six Color supporter. We appreciate it. And nice chatting with you, Dan, as always.
Too.
Bye.
Bye.